You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. For some, cases of possession are considered a modern fad, or outright hoaxing, or even symptoms that may suggest some form of illness. Yet, the more notable cases can be traced back all the way to the 16th century. And one particular case, documented by the notable preacher Samuel Willard, involved one of his servants, Elizabeth Knapp. Willard is a man for whom many are unaware of outside of Massachusetts these days, and yet, by his thoughtful and balanced recording of this case, he was clearly a man way ahead of his time. It's interesting to compare his response to this case, and what makes it so striking in comparison to the dreadful events that occurred in Salem some 20 years later. Ironically, Willard cautioned against the use of spectral evidence, but sadly, as we all know, his common sense approach fell on deaf ears. To discuss this case and his new book, Demons Among Us, is author and journalist M.R. Gorger, who invites us to consider the reality of demonic possession and the question of why so many cultures refer to such entities across the world. Before we get to that, don't forget you can support the show for $4 a month by clicking on the Patreon link in this week's show notes as always. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube by searching for Mysteries and Monsters. The website is, of course, mysteriesandmonsters.com. Artwork for the show is wonderfully created by Dean Bestel. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Groton, Massachusetts, in the autumn of 1671, was about to become host to something deeply unusual. Let's join M.R. Gorger to discover what that was. Today, I'm joined by M.R. Gorger, author of Demons Among Us, which peels back the veil of the paranormal to expose the true nature of evil and what it really looks like. His writing career now spans decades, and between writing, he plays a mean guitar, and it's always nice to meet someone who probably drinks as much coffee as I do. MR, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me, sir.
Hi, Paul. It's great to be on here. I'm so glad to be speaking with you today.
You're very welcome. I was very interested to see in your bio that you've had a talent for the darker arts in regards to writing. I know you refer to an incident as a child where you'd written a piece of work and you were concerned that you were going to get sort of dragged over the coals for your writing, but instead your teacher had the foresight to praise you.
It was one of those things. I was in elementary school, really young, had to be like in fourth or fifth grade. And so I wrote this story. It was a horror story, and something about a mummy, as I recall. And I thought the teacher, after reading it, he called my parents. And whenever you get a teacher calling, it's usually never good.
Yeah.
So I thought that I was going to get, in trouble for writing this kind of story, but instead he praised me and he said, your son has a real talent for writing. You better get him involved in the college writing program. Oh, Young Authors Club. Mm. You need to enroll him into the Young Authors Club now. And so he read them my story over the phone. I don't remember what their response was, but they were very shocked and surprised that the teacher had called and said that, he has a real talent for writing and you need to do something about it.
Well, it makes a pleasant change that you have such a positive role model at a young age, MR, because I would imagine that was one of the catalysts that sort of propelled you forwards into a love of writing.
Yeah, it's always been a love of mine. It's always been a part of me. And I've been writing professionally basically ever since in various forms of mediums. I started with magazines, and I ended up writing for marketing and advertising collateral as a copywriter for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been writing proficiently for, you know, a very, very long time.
Your latest book, Demons Among Us, is a very interesting approach to the whole subject of demons and demonology. What was it that enticed you into tackling such a subject? Because I can imagine, MR, it's one of those where it could be very easy to kind of follow a well-worn path that other authors and other investigators have kind of covered. But what struck me, and obviously this is something we're going to dive into, is that there's one particular case that you've managed to uncover that is remarkable in the fact that it just doesn't seem to have got any kind of history in the modern era. So how did you decide to approach this book, and why did you want to tackle it?
That story that you're talking about, that's chapter two. It's a truly, truly remarkable story that has really gotten no notoriety or no airplay, so to say. It's just this thing, for some reason or another, has been absolutely buried in history.
Mm.
And it's glossed over in other people's works. And so when I discovered it, I started to dig in a lot deeper. And the story was so fascinating, because the story that we're talking about, it's between a 16-year-old maid and a minister of a town in Massachusetts in 1671. And she starts showing signs of possession. So what happens is this minister, he decides to take to his journal and start writing everything that was going on blow by blow for 3 months straight.
Mm.
And how this went unnoticed in history is beyond me. It was decided when I found that, I said, this is a story that really deserves to be told.
Mm.
I decided to really bring this story to light by understanding the society that they are both in.
Mm.
And that took a lot of research. But I really went through 350 years of research, where I went through yellow parchment documents, court documents and records and sermon notes and just a plethora of information on parchment and flowing black script. I mean, we've really dug deep to bring this story to life, to really make this story as believable and credible as possible.
Mm. I think it's one of those things that when you start on a project, MR, and you decide that you're going to tackle a specific subject, when you uncover Samuel Willard's writing and what went on during that period of time back in the early 1670s, I suppose you're kind of rubbing your hands and thinking, I can't believe I've stumbled across this. Because as you touch on there, the Reverend Samuel Willard is a remarkable man. And as we were saying off air, he seems to be one of those people, and you can find it in all walks of life, I find, MR, that certain people who are groundbreaking or forward-thinking are often forgotten 100, 200 years later. And Willard certainly seems to be a key person in that kind of regard, does he not?
In that regard, for sure, yeah. I mean, and what he did in that period, that in the 1670s and 1700s, he really, really was one of the most influential figures of his time. I mean, the ministers at that time, they were basically the rock stars of our day. So there was really no more influential person in the community other than the minister or the preacher. And kids ascribed to wanted to be a preacher, and they wanted to, you know, they really looked up to this clerical figure, and they wanted to be that in their communities as well. And with Samuel Willard, it's just a fascinating, fascinating thing. I mean, he not only was part of in the witch trials, the Salem witch trials that took place 20 years later, He was instrumental in trying to stop them. So I found records on that. There's literally the argument that he was having was that, you know, his argument was against the spectral evidence or the, you know, the ghost evidence, if you will, meaning that people can take the form of other people and attack them by this power given by the devil, attack them in this image.
Mm.
And then they would, you know, astral plane back into their body. So he was arguing against this, saying, if you allow this, this is you could just say this about anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was really, really different in regards to even during the panic, the height of the panic, he showed himself very moderate, saying this, you allow this into the court, this is going to be a disaster.
Mm.
So and he was right. Because, you know, a lot of people died, 19 people died in that who, you know, were, some of them were wrongly accused, you know. Mm-hmm. But he tried to stop that. But he went on to also be the acting president of Harvard College. And posthumously, what was published was his Body of Divinity, which was taught for 100 years mm-hmm. at the college after he died. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about this really... This figure is so influential of that period that nobody knows about.
Yeah. I was very struck by that, as you refer to MR, in regards to how he behaved and carried himself during his involvement in the Salem witch trials, because as you refer to there, I think when you look at that period, there's a lot of hysteria and people just following the crowd that went on there. And it would have been extremely easy for a man of the cloth in that period to have simply gone along with everybody. But as you refer to, he didn't. He really made a stand against this and said, you know, you're wrong. This is not where we should be dealing with this. This is not how we should be treating these people. And as you refer to, he was ignored and they just carried on regardless. And I think that's a remarkable thing for a man of that age in that climate and in that environment that was going on at that time.
It's a hard thing, too, because, you know, if you take into account some of the, you know, the crazes that have taken place in America or Britain or any kind of thing that washes over society, it's so easy to get wrapped up into that fear or that panic or that sway. You know, it's like today where you have I'll just use the coronavirus fears as an example because it's the greatest of the day. Well, so you have other people who are not believing this fear whatsoever, right? But then you have this massive society that says, no, you got to wear your mask and we're all going to die. Well, you know, picture being the one man that stands against that and says, this is a crock, you know, or, you know, this is not what you think it is and stands against it. That's what it would be like.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So how did you come across this story as well, MR? Because I would imagine it's one of those, as you say, it seems to have been very lightly touched by other authors and other researchers over decades. As I said at the beginning, it seems remarkable to me that a case as well documented as this as well, because obviously, as we've said, Willard was a man of words and a man of writing. He was clearly someone who was ahead of his time. So how did you stumble across it? Where did you find these reports and writings?
That, you know, that's a really great question. And I think that's somewhere of something of the investigator in me.
Mm.
You know, like I said earlier, I started out in magazines. So in order to really get to the bottom of a story, you really kind of had to research. So it's that research kind of reporter side of me that decided to really dig into the details. And I found in a work somewhere, I can't remember, the name is escaping me right now. And the author had just kind of like had mentioned it and then just kind of glossed over it. And I remember seeing an ellipsis, right? And it was like it was explaining something. And then there was an ellipsis, you know, three dots. And I said, well, what's between those dots? I said, there's got to be more here. And there was no mention of a journal. There was no mention of nothing. It was just sort of like so matter of fact, oh, this happened and that happened and on to the next thing. Mm. And I said, there's got to be something more here. And I just kind of like, you know, I just started, you know, really just sniffing it out. And when I discovered the journals, reading it, I was just blown away of the things that he was – that he journaled and chronicled with his own hand and found these situations so bizarre that they needed to be written down somewhere.
Yeah.
And not only were they written down, but when he finished, he gave it to the most important man at the time in Boston, Increase Mather, who was, you know, he was like the, he was the guy of that period. So he found it important enough to give to the most important person of that period for his evaluation.
Yeah, yeah.
And but yeah, I think it was just the investigative side of me. And once I started, you know, peeling back that onion and I saw just these crazy episodes, and you can read about them in the book, you know, about being tempted of the devil and being Elizabeth being presented with, you know, with the contract and, you know, just getting beat up by devils. I mean, it's just, and how this story has gone untold is beyond me, but I'm so glad that I am actually the one to actually bring this to the light.
Yeah. It is a very interesting aspect as well, because it's one of those incidents that often we come across, MR, where Willard is well established in the community and Elizabeth Knapp is this young lady that is placed into his service, which is quite unusual as well, because I was very interested to see that it's almost as if she's moved out of her home and basically given to the Reverend and said, right, here you are, here's a servant.
Yeah, well, that's the perplexing part that I really tried to understand what was going on at that culture of that time. And it has to do with the social mindset at that time. And I really believe that her father, James Knapp, what had happened was, you know, they were lower middle class. They would be considered as a family lower middle class. And there would really have not been much chance for Elizabeth to have any kind of success anywhere, except especially as a young girl, or even coming into as a woman, because it would have been the only way out of the social constructs or confines that they had. What I mean by that is that their station in life was thought to be providential or given by God, and to try to raise up out of that social standing, wherever you were on that social ladder, was considered something of against God, right? So she would have had no way of really bettering herself except through marriage, or being a servant somewhere. And I think in the mind of James Knapp, if he gave her over to the care of Samuel Willard, well, he would have been responsible for teaching her to read and write. He would have been responsible for clothing her, for feeding her, and for housing her. And it really would have been a very economical thing for her father to do this. So I think all of these factors actually entered into that kind of a decision.
Yeah.
Like, this would be better for her. And, oh, by the way, I could be close to the most influential man in the community. Mm. So in that regard, trying to understand the culture, it kind of makes sense, but it doesn't make sense to our modern thinking.
Yeah, very true. I mean, it is clearly very much of its time, MR, as you refer to there, in the way that this kind of relationship has developed. It's almost as if, as you touch on there, James, her father, is trying to sort of ingratiate himself into the Reverend's social circle by this offering of his child as a housemaid. And Elizabeth seems to be a fairly normal young lady. She's popular. She's well liked. She seems to be quite intelligent for that era. So it's not as if she's a burden on anybody. It's quite a peculiar situation.
No, I mean, and she would have been a great and dutiful worker, for that period, or she would have never gotten even a look at inside of Sammy Willard's home. So she really, for that period, and for back then, it was hard work. We're not talking about just sitting around, sewing or anything like that. I mean, she would have been involved in some serious work, would have been like chopping wood, mending fences, like some of the harder work that would have been out there among the frontier. Let's not forget, they're in the middle of the woods. So there is a lot to do on that frontier life that's very, very burdensome, and it was those burdens that helped create an opening for the demonic to enter in.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those stories as well where, and I've seen this in similar kind of situations, MR, in regards to certain poltergeist manifestations where everything seems to be very normal. Everything's going well. Elizabeth has started working, and as you refer to, she's noted for her hard-working ethic. She has made herself quite popular. She seems to be a friendly and dutiful young woman. Clearly, as you touch on there, works very hard and of a high standard, and everything seems to be just going along wonderfully well. It probably couldn't have gone any better for the young woman. And then I think, is it the Reverend himself notices or hears Elizabeth is simply sweeping in a room somewhere, and she just starts to giggle for no reason.
Exactly. Yep. It starts off as like a little laugh, and then it just the creep factor just kind of sparks up from there, and so, but there was things that he found odd for about 2 weeks before he started to write. So it was at first it would have been peculiar to him, but then in the mind it's like, ah, well, maybe it's nothing, or maybe she's just weird, or maybe I don't know, whatever he was thinking. But after 2 weeks of seeing these things, I guess they escalated, and he started to see that it was important enough to journal, to write down,
Yeah. I think what also strikes me in regards to the way that Samuel Willard deals with this, MR, is that it would have been very easy for him to have just thrown her out and got rid of her and said, no, I'm not dealing with this. Or, as we've touched on earlier, to sort of fall into those cliches of witchcraft and demons and just, throw the poor girl to the lions. And once again, I think this shows the magnitude of the man that the Reverend was, that he didn't do that. He didn't act as we would suspect people would do in that era. He basically went, right, well, I'm going to try and help this young lady and save her.
And that's exactly right. I mean, because in what I found is, he had the real and true heart of a cleric, or of a clergyman, someone as a follower of Christ and a leader of the community. He had a heart and a passion for her soul. And this is the core of who Samuel Willard was. He wasn't just willing to go through and say, well, oh, this is freaky, we better get this out of here, or we better bring her to the magistrates to see what they think. And he knew that she would be hung. And so he really did. It really just expresses who he was as a leader, as a person, and as a follower or believer in Jesus Christ. He had the heart for this girl's soul, and that was his driving force, was to save this girl. And he did something that was just very, very shocking for the time, I think. Anyway, was he was like, well, maybe this could be something medical. So he gets the doctor. Obviously, it's the doctor has the knowledge of that time, right? And and he has the doctor check her out, and he thought he can kind of cure her with some, physic or, medicine. And but he did a smart thing by trying to, check the boxes off, like, okay, it's not medical, it's not this, and it's not that. Well, then this is a spiritual issue. You know, so he really went through all of the avenues he could have in order to not come to the conclusion that it was just witchcraft and possession.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is remarkable, as you say, because once again, he seems to be a man ahead of his time, because that's just, it's almost as if he's making sure it isn't what he probably fears it could be, MR. He
yes.
wants it to be a medical condition. He wants the girl to perhaps have some kind of ailment or disease that is causing these strange afflictions that seem to be occurring.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And let's not forget that, you know, as the pastor of that community, he, aside from her living in the house, he knew who she was. She was his part of his flock,
yeah.
and part of his congregation. So, you know, you have to understand, I mean, these people, they lived in the frontier. They didn't live in this big city where you wouldn't know anybody. And this was a very, very small community living in the wilds of the frontier.
Yes.
And so this would have been a very, very tight-knit community. This wasn't like a stranger that he let in that just kind of foraged in from the forest. This was someone he knew intimately in his congregation who he allowed in his house. And so that factored into it as well. He was just not willing to throw her to the wolves. But yeah, as ahead of his time, I would agree that that's something that would have been so far ahead of the time for that period, where so many were so willing, even in Europe at that time, where they burned witches, you know, to fall into that hysteria. He refused to do it because I do believe that in his mind, he didn't want to think that that's what it was. But even though, and you can read this in the book, he knew in his heart but didn't want to believe it.
And I mean, even the doctors are saying, oh, yeah, well, this is perfectly normal. Which, when you start to read what Elizabeth's going through and what's happening, you begin to think, well, what on earth has this doctor dealt with previously, MR? I was a little bit like, sort of, I'm not really sure he knows what's going on anyway.
Well, they would have had, like, you know, back at that time, they called diseases of astonishment and epilepsy and all those kinds of things. So to him, it would have been some kind of form of epileptic thing or some kind of seizure or something in those regards. And I think, or frenetic melancholy. And so he would have looked at it through the lens of a doctor. I'm sure he saw something of it before, of something that looks similar. So he's, you know, and he's a doctor. He's got to say something.
Yes.
If it's a profession, he just can't say, well, you know what? I don't know what the heck this is. And he's got to say something.
Yeah.
Right? And and so, and he thought that, you know, he'd just give her some medication and, you know, much like any other doctor today, you know, we could fix this with some pills and everything will be all right. Give her some rest and we'll call it a day. But as we find out in the book, that's not the case.
I mean, when you were researching this and reading Willard's writings, MR, were you surprised at how balanced and modern he seems to be in regards to this? Because that's what strikes me about his reporting and his the way he's taking his notes throughout this period of time, which I think is about 3 or 4 months, isn't it, that Elizabeth is afflicted in this manner.
That's true. Yeah.
It's one of those when I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, this could have happened 50 years ago, the way this Reverend is dealing with this. He's, as I've said several times, a man out of time for me. He could have been anybody in the last 300 years at any period of time, because he's so alien to what we expect a reverend to be like at that time.
Well, there lies the issue, is because, first of all, I think Samuel Willard had it right. He was a man of deep prayer and deep study and deep theological thought.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you have your teachings taught for 100 years after you die without being some sort of revolutionary kind of figure, right? And back then they were called divines too. So, you know, he would have been, you know, the community's divine. He is, to me, the way I see it, is the balance comes from something he got through prayer, mm-hmm. through his relationship with Christ, mm-hmm. where it didn't get muddled with religiosity.
Yep.
But really rested on the power of the Holy Spirit to kind of guide him and direct him in this balanced path. And what you see in the other preachers who got caught up in the hysteria was they allowed themselves to get caught up in the hysteria, but maybe they weren't in as much prayer, maybe they weren't in as much study, maybe they were more religious in a rigid sense rather than a more free sense of, you know, asking God, hey, what's going on here, yeah. right? And kind of receiving the order from and the balanced approach from on high.
Yeah.
So I really think that there was something revelatory or divine or providential about what he was getting that made him so opposite of everyone else.
Do you think this experience is what set him apart in later life from other members of the clergy, MR, in regards to, you know, as we touch on, his involvement in the Salem witch trials, because he'd actually witnessed something so unusual firsthand and dealt with it in such a positive and forgiving manner as well? Do you think that kind of set his path for the rest of his life, that he would be a more thoughtful, more considerate person when dealing or faced with such allegations at that period?
Unquestionably. I mean, this is the very reason why he was involved in the Salem witch trials, was directly impacted by the case with Elizabeth Knapp.
Mm.
And, you know, so that's why he was there. And he was at that time in Boston, because he started preaching at Old South Church by that time. So here we have these two instances. And, you know, the case with Elizabeth Knapp would have been a 3-month period of his life.
Mm.
And but it's so bizarre that it kind of like overshadows this whole volume of 200 sermons in the complete body of divinity that was taught for like 100 years. And, you know, so you get these bizarre cases that kind of overshadow the whole of the man's career and teaching. And so, but it was that case in Groton that really made him called upon for the Salem. And there's transcripts of the of that argument, of the case that he laid out, you know, that it was transcribed. And like I said, he was arguing against that spectral evidence, meaning that, you know, you could say this about anybody. This is, you know, but he really argued against it. He really argued against the trials, but it was his modest approach or his balanced approach that was so rare in that case. But his voice was needed because of the experience he went through with Elizabeth.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the other things that really strikes me about Willard is, especially when he's writing about this incident, MR, he's very forensic. He tells us exactly what he's gone through, what he's done, and why he believes this to be some kind of supernatural incident. Because I know there's moments where he talks about her being unable to talk. People would say, oh, well, perhaps she's just putting it on. And he'll say, no, I know. We tried to make her talk. We've tried to loosen her tongue. Mm-hmm. There were times where her throat would swell up, her body would change, her face would contort. And he notes everything in such a forensic level of detail that, once again, it's very striking that he is very regimented. He knows exactly what he's looking for, and he's building a body of proof, essentially, to justify why he believes this case to be so remarkable, so unusual. And once again, it's incredible that he had the foresight to deal with it in such a manner.
And that's a remarkable thing, too, because, you know, this stuff was happening, like, around his family. So, you know,
yes,
something could have happened to the, you know, she had charge over, or, you know, over the kids, and she would, you know, have to take care of the kids in some form or fashion. And so there would have been, like, a real and honest threat, you know. But no, he was very, very forensic in his approach. And what is astounding is that you get his inner thoughts.
Mm.
You know, when he says things like, "What to make of this? I know not."
Mm.
You know, in certain instances, I don't want to give everything away.
Yeah. Yep.
But, right, but it's like when he pens his absolute most inner thoughts, his doubts are there, his concerns are there. I mean, he really was doing this in a sense where it's like, I, for whatever was in him, felt that this thing really needs to be meticulously recorded.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, whether it was just to report to increase Mather, or whether it was, you know, for posterity, something inside Samuel Willard said, you need to write all of this down. Mm-hmm. And he did. And it's just astounding.
Yeah. I think one of the other things that's very striking as well, MR, is he's very honest throughout it as well. He doesn't leap to ridiculous conclusions. I know there's one bit where people say, well, was she truly possessed? And Willard says, that's not for me to decide. I will leave that decision to more learned men than I. Which, when you look at Willard and the way he was, that's a hell of a statement, because I don't think there were many more intelligent and balanced men around at that era.
No. And, you know, he says, I will leave that to more learned and judicious men around, right?
Yes.
It's like, okay, well, who was more learned and judicious? So we really see, it shows to me that there's a humbleness to him as well. Like, he's just not going to say, well, this is what it is. And he wasn't that arrogant, you know. He saw things that were so bizarre that they couldn't possibly be normal.
Yeah.
And was this a case of possession? I'm sure he knew. But for the total conclusion, he was just like, okay, I'm going to write all of this down, and I'm going to let the more judicious among us determine whether this is it, whether this is the real thing or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what he did. And, you know, just as a side note, this case was it put religious and medical societies at odds for like over 100 years. Because I found something in a Massachusetts medical journal from 1860, something very old. And they were arguing the case. And their thing was like, well, maybe she was a ventriloquist. Which I doubt. I don't see her off in a corner somewhere,
yes,
saying, how can I throw my voice? I don't even think it's anything that would have entered her mind.
Yeah. 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 Well, this is the thing as well, you know, we're talking about a child of humble origins, MR.
Yes. She would have not known this.
Nobody would. I would be amazed if anybody in that kind of community would even know what a ventriloquist was or what ventriloquism meant.
That's exactly right. I mean, I couldn't agree more, because that would not even have been their mindset. Again, this was a forest life. This was a hard, burdensome life. The work would have been like unending. So for her to go off in the corner somewhere and say, you know what? I really want to find out how I can throw my voice around. Like, it's just... it wouldn't have made any sense to her character.
I think often when we find people who discuss this, and I know you touch on it, that a lot of people have tried to sort of look back at this case and, as you refer to there, give us explanations, but nobody did at the time. And I think when you're looking back at something through the prism of history, it's very easy to leap to ridiculous conclusions, as we've just touched on there about ventriloquism and the like. When, you know, we've got a real record of reporting, of investigation, of testing, And yet people, I think it's one of those that someone will sometimes say, oh, well, I think it's this. I'm going to ignore everything that contradicts what I think, as we're saying here about this young lady who apparently knows what ventriloquism is, despite living in the middle of the woods, you know, in 1671 or wherever I'm at. Or you find out that, oh, maybe she's a contortionist, or she's developed a thirst for acting. These are situations and experiences that these people would, it would be as alien to them as probably a mobile phone in this day and age. They would have no concept of that kind of behavior, would they?
No, absolutely none. I mean, everybody's an armchair quarterback, are they not? Are they?
Very true.
It's very, very easy to look back and say, well, maybe it could have been this. And that's why I made it a real point to say, well, Sammy Willard had a front row eyewitness seat. Mm. And he's the only one.
Yes.
Who can accurately say, without doubt, what happened. And he's a very credible source because he was the most influential man of the community, mm-hmm. right? He was not known as a liar
yeah.
in any way, shape, or form. And I highly doubt he would concoct this kind of story.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's very, very easy to kind of like dismiss it or kind of come up with these ideas, but it's very, very difficult to negate an eyewitness.
Especially one of such stature as well.
That's right. When it comes to the community, he was it. There was no one higher. There was no one more influential. There was no one more powerful when it came to decision making. And even with judicialist decisions, because back at that point, the reverends were very, very instrumental in the lawmaking and the judging. And so the judges would go to these reverends and they would have to prayerfully consider. So the judicial system back then even relied on their influence.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about a liar. We're not talking about, we're not talking about a questionable character in history. We're talking about somebody who is learned, educated, and the most influential in a society.
Yeah. Do you think that this case, as we've said a couple of times, MR, Willard is one of those people who really should be more well known than he is. And I know you were saying that there are a few streets and things in Massachusetts that are named after him. Do you think that this case has hampered his reputation at some point over the last 200 years where basically people have looked at this case and gone, we don't really want to promote this gentleman?
Well, it's tough to say. I mean, his influence was obviously well felt, you know, in order to name schools and roads and, you know, and community civic things after him.
Mm.
So, no, I don't think at all, because his reputation as acting president of Harvard would tell me, no, this did not stain or blight him in any way. If anything, it made him it was made for a controversial thing to be a part of.
Yeah.
But again, he had this massively long career as a, you know, as a cleric and a divine. And, you know, his studies and his learnings, they were taught for 100 years. So, no, I don't think it had any kind of like real negative impact on him. His influence, because of his the spread of his influence of that time, that shows me that, no, this did not have any negative impact on him. But in fact, he was so influential that really didn't seem to like make a dent. If anything, it added to him.
Certainly. I think it, like I say, everything that I read and discovered by reading this gives the impression of a very impressive.
Welcome to Kraken Murray, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
Deep thinking, honest, humble, sincere man.
Yes. Yes.
And it's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. I mean, I'm just astounded. As you've touched on, it's a case that, because we know so many other cases of a very similar nature, more so in the modern era, especially with the furore about the Salem witch trials that happened shortly afterwards as well.
Right.
It's baffling to me, MR, that this case isn't well known at all.
Well, that's why you have to pick up this book, Demons Among Us, to find out about it, because you're not going to find out about it anywhere else. It's really the only fully reported case that I've found anywhere about this case. And Demons Among Us is the only book you're going to find it so hashed out where you can literally touch and know these people. You will know his mind, you will know his thinking, you will watch this possession case with him. And Demons Among Us is the only book that I found that you can do that with.
It is remarkable, and it's a fantastic level of investigation and reporting that you've collated there, MR.
Thank you.
When you were pulling the book together, would you say you came across anything that surprised you when you were peering into the world of demons and demonology?
Yes. Yes. There were a few things that really kind of took me by surprise. And one of the things is just that connection to the past. I mean, I've heard people say this before, and I thought it was cliche, but it's really the God's honest truth. Was I really seriously felt a connection to this man, to this figure. So it was like as if I could know him, right?
Yeah.
So the level of connection surprised me. And then another thing that surprised me is that when I was sifting through the actual records in Boston, the level of connect I was pouring, I think, over some of the sermon, and something came over me, some kind of like supernatural sensation or power that these documents are still living.
Yeah.
There's still power emanating from these documents, and it just kind of like overwhelmed me. I couldn't explain it. I can't explain the sensation, but it's just something that, you know, that touched me, that came, it washed over me. This sense of this sense of this power still speaking from these documents. And it was just, I didn't expect it. I didn't, you know, no one could have told me something like this was going to happen, but it was just this overwhelming sense and connection that washed over me that these documents are alive and they're still speaking. And so, and to me, I saw it as, well, this needs to be out there. People need to know about this. So those are like two things, that connection, and also the history of, you know, because we're talking about the very, very roots of America itself. And so Samuel Willard was one of the first generation to be born after the migration from England. And so there's this, you know, there's this British and this, you know, his father was from Kent. And so there's this British and American, the roots of America that I found were have taken me by surprise, because towards the end of his life, he baptized Benjamin Franklin. And as we know, Benjamin Franklin was instrumental in, you know, you know, founding this country.
Yeah.
So he has these deep roots and influence of America itself. So, and it's that American side of me, or the American side of that thing, the foundations of this country, I found very, very surprising as well.
I think one of the other aspects of this is that I think in the modern era, a lot of people tend to suspect that demons are more of a modern invention, MR. And yet, I know you touch on it in the book, in the introduction, these entities, these malevolent creatures of the dark, seem to have touched every culture, every religion, on every continent across the world, going back thousands of years. So are you surprised that people don't realise just how far back demons reach?
I don't know if it really consciously comes to mind, because I think they look at it as a very in a very now sense. And what I mean by that is, like, if somebody has an experience of some sort of ghostly or malevolent experience, well, that's just something that happened to me now, right? And you don't think about how ancient and how long they've been here. You just kind of think about your immediate experience. So, and I think it kind of, it doesn't really register in the minds of, you know, people who, like, investigate the paranormal and things of that nature, how long demons have been among us.
Yeah. I mean, is it something that you found? Well, I mean, I find it very interesting that they are prevalent in all culture, regardless of any kind of connection. And often we will find through history that civilizations or invaders will absorb cultures. And I often find it very interesting that these creatures seem to survive even this kind of religious amalgamation, MR. Regardless of who's taking over who, the demons seem to continue bobbing along regardless of which church or which faith seems to be running that particular area.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, that's why, you know, because of it's been known in every culture, that's what makes it so hard to dismiss. Mm. And that's why I try to write from a very a very balanced position. Mm. The opening of the book starts off with a Chinese philosopher quote, right? And, you know, it says, if from antiquity to the present and since the beginning of man, there are men who have seen the bodies of ghosts and spirits and have heard their voices, how can we say that they do not exist? So this is from the Chinese culture.
Yes.
And then you have these instances from, you know, the Arabic culture, and you have the Hindu culture, and you have, like, you know, so all of these cultures can't be crazy. Mm. If anything, it attests to the reality of these are beings that have been here and are here, and how they keep bobbing along is because they're supernatural creatures. They're beings, supernatural beings that they don't care who's president in regard to, like, their influence is going to have any influence over them. Because why? Because they're supernatural beings. They're smarter. They're stronger. They're invisible. They're wiser. They're all of these things, and they're ancient, and they have all kinds of knowledge of, you know, everything. And then, and so in regards to influence, yeah, they influence people in government. They influence people in society. And if you can think about demons in a sense of in a marketing sense, influencer marketing, in a sense, you want to take the most influential person because you can have the most sway over the most people, right? Mm. And in that sense, if demons can introduce an idea into a high-powered leader or any influencer in society, well, then they can spread that ideology throughout all of society. So it's not like they come with horns and pitchforks, and that would be obvious, right?
Yep.
And so, and that's how demons work. I mean, they have influence and ideas, and they have their own agenda too, and it's to steal, kill, and destroy. And they do that through people.
Do you find it interesting that throughout culture we seem to have a varying interpretation of this? I know, as you touch on, we look at some of the demons that wandered around Mesopotamia and Hebrew writings, and also Greek and Roman and Egyptians.
Right.
And yet, as we move into the modern era, we seem to see things that change into things like succubuses and incubuses. And then in the modern era, we seem to have seen people suffering from what are called night terrors, and things such as the old hag, the shadow man, shadow beings. There seems to be not necessarily a constant revision about them, MR, but being dark, shapeless figures seem to have been on the periphery of culture and society for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, they because they are supernatural creatures, beings, they do have the ability to transform into anything they want. In the biblical sense, the Bible even says that, you know, even the devil himself transforms himself into an angel of light.
Yeah.
Well, that's a scary thing because you have the most malevolent being ever to walk the earth in the form of the most good or holy thing in order to deceive. That's a scary thought if you really put some thought to it. And because they have the power to change into any image they want, they could take on the image of a ghost. They could take on the image of a grandmother. They can mimic the voice of your dear old grandma, right? They can assume the identity or whoever they want, because they're not limited to the confines of our own flesh or our own carnal skin. They're not confined to it.
Yeah, the rules don't apply.
No, they don't. Not at all. Yeah. So they'll take on and assume the different identities and roles. And that's why you have, you know, black shadow people. And then you have like these different forms that show up. But what remains constant is the malevolence, because you'll hear people say over and over and over again, I can feel the evil. Right? Over and again, you'll hear people say that they can literally feel the evil. And that's because it's just the same evil wrapped up in a different wrapper. You know, it still has the same goal and intent and all that stuff. And in regard to the incubus and succubus spirits, spirits that come to you at night and try to have sex with you, those have always been around. Those have been reported for, you know, centuries and centuries, and even that's in the Bible as well. It says that the sons of God had come down and mated with the daughters of Eve, or however it says it.
Yeah.
And it says that they gave birth to children which were called Nephilim. Mm-hmm. And these Nephilim were the giants. And so, and then they called them like renowned men of renown or whatever. But having sex with demons, that's been around for a long time. And you can even find that in the witches culture too, because even in modern times, there's a woman who wrote a book, and she said that she was groomed to be the bride of Christ. I mean, the bride of the devil.
Yeah.
And so even in modern times, it happens.
I mean, that is another aspect of all this that surprises me, because once again, you have that seems to pollinate into different cultures at a time where people would not be sharing these ideas on different continents. Essentially, these cultures have grown up alone from each other, and yet we still have these same kind of rules that seem to apply to these beings.
Yeah, this is an amazing thing, and I was having a conversation with somebody not so long ago, and you will find that the rituals of the Native American Indians, witches, voodoo in the Caribbean, sacrifice in the Mayan. I mean, you take any culture, and outside of them being a Christian culture or worshiping in the Christian manner, all of the rituals are the same. There's fire, there's tobacco, there's alcohol, there's dancing around the fire, there's animal sacrifice, and it's with that, which with the early witch culture, it's with the early Native Americans, it's the same thing, because what we're talking about is the influence of the same demons. There's no way the Native Americans from from before we landed in America knew anything going on in the Caribbean or halfway or all the way across the world of that specific same rituals involved in each one, or offering a demon a token in that sense. So they all have the same aspects because there's this inspiration, a demonic inspiration that's given on how to worship these demons, whatever you want to call them. You want to call them by different names, it doesn't matter. They still have given the same directions.
It's a fascinating book. I found it both thought-provoking and eye-opening, and just the section about Willard is remarkable, and I recommend it to anybody who has a love of paranormal history, possession, demons, demonology, whatever, MR. It's a fantastically collated breakdown of the events that happened, and you should be congratulated on both uncovering it and bringing it to our attention. So where can everybody get hold of a copy of the book and follow your work, and what's coming up next for you?
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. I mean, it was a labor of love, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. You can get Demons Among Us right now. It's available at Amazon.com, and look for the book with the creepy white face, since the listeners can't see me. I mean, the book, not me, the book.
Yes.
But it's the book with the creepy white face, because there's other titles out there of the same name. Mm. Shocking Real Life Stories from the Paranormal. You can find that on Amazon. It's available in Kindle, and it's available in paperback. And I think you can read it for free on Kindle Unlimited. Mm-hmm. And you can find me on Instagram at m.r.gorga, as well as on Facebook at mrgorga. So just kind of put those into your search and you'll find me.
Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure I put links to everything and the book on Amazon as well for anybody that wants to track it down. As you say, it's a fascinating read. Some brilliant research. And I'm very appreciative of the scary cover as well. It's a great image. Very striking. So, MR, what's next for you after this wonderful tome? Because, as you refer to, it's clearly been a labour of love. Has it kind of given you a thirst for trying to uncover some more lost stories of such a nature?
Well, it has sparked up a lot of I find that a lot of people are coming to me with their stories.
Yes, yes.
Which was a very opposite thing I thought was going to happen. I thought I was going to be seen as some, you know, nut. And quite the opposite has happened. It was everyone's coming at me like, well, I've had this happen to me, and you know, I've had these experiences. So I don't want to take any of their stories, but what's coming up next for me is I am currently involved in writing the next book, and right now I'm in this deep research stage. So the same level of research I put into the Willard possession story is the same level of research I'm putting into to understand and know the culture and the world I'm going to put my new characters in. Mm-hmm. And so we can look forward to that. I don't want to give away the title just yet, but it will be a paranormal read of epic proportions. I can promise you that.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I think as you refer to there as well, often when anybody writes a book about a difficult subject for some people, be it demons or ghosts or possession or alien encounters or whatever, MR, people will often come to the author because they realise that this person is probably going to listen to them in a balanced manner without being judgmental. And I think you will probably end up getting a lot more of people coming forwards with their experience to share with you, my friend.
Well, that is true. I mean, because one thing for sure I can say is if these things have happened to you, a common fear is, well, they're going to think I'm crazy. I'm not going to think you're crazy. I'm quite certain you've had an experience. So many people have had experiences that it's not even fair to even think that you're crazy at this point. You know, from my perspective, not even fair to even think you're crazy when these things are actually more common than you think.
Thank you again for your time. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you about your work and that case in particular. So I wish you all the very best. We look forward to what you've got in store for us next. And one day, no doubt, we'll probably talk again, my friend. So thank you, MR.
I hope so. Thank you for having me on. It's been an amazing time. Thank you. I appreciate it.